Parshas Vayeshev, we have the Parsha of Yehuda and Tamar, and in the past we've used the occasion to discuss some elements of the mitzvah of Yibum Chalitza, given the comment in the Ramban in that episode of Yehuda and Tamar, that there is a notion of Yibum within the world before Matan Torah, even independent of the strict halachic requirement of Yibum, that there's such a notion in the Umos HaOlam, and that was reflected in the mitzvah of Yehuda and Tamar. What I wanted to discuss tonight is more of an interesting historical event, more than a halachic event. We'll focus a little more on the history than the halacha, which is not our normal way of doing things, but a fascinating episode that I recently came across for the first time that does touch on something related to chalitza. The background to the episode that I want to discuss is the context of the Kuntres Ein Tanai V'Nisuin, which was originally published in the around 1930, but discusses events that took place in France between the 1880s and the 1910s. And I recently noticed in looking at the relatively recently published biography of Chaim Moser, published by Rabbi David Kamenetsky, son of Rabbi Shmuel, where he described the background of why it was that this Kuntres Ein Tanai V'Nisuin was only published over 20 years after the events that it describes. So the context of this Kuntres Ein Tanai V'Nisuin was that in the 1880s, France legalized civil divorce for the first time. As a Catholic country, there was no notion of divorce up until that point. And as the Hakdama to this Kuntres Ein Tanai V'Nisuin points out, that even among the Jewish communities in France, there is a strong reluctance to allow for divorce, which was, the way he presents it, a carryover from the society in which they lived. And they viewed divorce as something that Eastern European Jews did, but it wasn't befitting of the French culture. But then, as soon as there was a legal mechanism for divorce through the civil system, that seeped into the Jewish community as well. And there was a call from some sectors in the Jewish community to conform to secular law. There was a concern, for example, that given that secular law then allowed for a judge to grant divorce in such a way that you didn't need the consent of both parties. So there's a concern that maybe you'd have a vindictive husband who was civilly divorced from his wife against his will, who would then withhold a get. So in the 1880s, a certain Rabbi Michal Weil in France ruled that civil divorce was halachically sufficient and there was no need for a get beyond the civil divorce decree. And basing himself on clearly unfounded understandings of halacha, but misquoting a Gemara in Gittin Daf Yud Aleph that has a notion of a get Shenasa Barkov Shel Akum being kosher. The real context there is you have a properly executed get that's signed by non-Jewish witnesses, which under certain circumstances may be acceptable on some level, but that doesn't mean that if you have a civil divorce decree from the courts, that that would be acceptable. And there was a discussion that he had of invoking some form of afkeinu, of uprooting the Kedushin in favor of wants a civil divorce. Whatever his arguments were, they were clearly rejected by everybody else in the rabbinate. But a little bit later on, as the years moved on, the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, there was another movement in France that gained a little bit more traction, which was to solve the problem of this discrepancy between civil divorce and halachic divorce. The suggestion was that people should make a tanai condition at the time that they affected kedushin, and they should use language along these lines of hareya mikudeshesli beim sheshoftei hamemshala yigarshu osanu. So the kedushin is conditional with the proviso that if the civil authorities will grant a divorce, lo etem lecha sefer krisus kedas moshe v'shalani, he won't give you a get, then lo yachalu kedushin, then it should turn out retroactively that the Kedushin warrant chal. And that's what brought the wrath and the ire of the entire rabbinic establishment again across the world against this suggestion, because of number one, it's lack of halachic coherence, and number two, the slippery slope that it could lead to in totally eradicating Kedushin, the Gittin. Before getting to the Ein Tanai B'Nisuin Kutris, the basic background for what such a suggestion was based on is from a couple of Gemaras. First is the Gemara in Bava Kamma Daf Kuf Yud, where the Gemara has Elamiata Yevama Shenafel if they mukashkin tapik below chalita. So would you suggest that if a Yevama has a zika to a brother-in-law who is a mukashkin, who has a severe dermatological condition that would make him an undesirable spouse and perhaps a dangerous spouse to have a relationship with. So in that case, would you say tevik below chalitza, that there would be no zika, you wouldn't need chalitza, that daita the hachi lo kitcha atma, that she would never agree, would have, she never agreed to enter into kedushin with her first husband, with the if the possibility existed that she'd have to do chalitza or yibam with a sect with the brother-in-law. So the Gemara says hasaman ansadi the meinach nichalu b'kaldu. No, don't say such a thing because we assume there's an umdana that a woman would rather be married to anyone, even a mukashkin, even a non-desirable person, than being single. So the Gemara there introduces the possibility that maybe if Tavla Mesa wouldn't exist, then there's a notion of adaita d'achi lo kitsh atma, that a woman wouldn't have entered into kedushin under such pretenses. Tosas there severely limits this. Nira debenafim and erusin iri. So the whole discussion here, the possibility of invoking a daita d'achilo kisha asma is only if there's only erusin. But in the nesuah vada mekachin afsha kadesh shebe nesuah lebayla mishum achar misas bayla la maska nafsha melias nesuah element erusin iri. The Tosa says that no, there's no possibility. If they're ready with nesuin, then you couldn't say that a daita d'achilo kisha asma in a case of nesuin. After all, to go back and then retroactively invalidate the kedushin or the nesuin after nesuin would mean that you were engaging in be'ilas nus that whole time, and no one would allow for that. So Tosis limits the possibility of a daita d'achilo kitsha. Not only Rishon of Tosis, Mordechai doesn't, and this has resonance lalach in the following context. The Mechaber writes in Simon Kufnin Zion Evin Ezer Seif Dalid. If there is a zika to a yabam who's a mummer, a good old-fashioned apostate, so there is a position that there's no need for yibam slash chalitza if this person was a mummer when they get married. But we don't accept such a minority position that there's no need for chalitza for an ach mummer. However, the Rambam says that Hamakadesh Isha Vieshlo Achmumr, Yochalakadesh Ulahasnos, but tonight Kafol, Shem Tipol of Neamumr, Layibum, Shalotahe Mukudeshes. There is a possibility based on a Chumas Hadeshen that if a woman's getting married and there's an Achmumr, and there's a possibility in the back of her mind that maybe if her husband's going to die and she won't have children with him and she'll have a Zika to this Achmumr, and that would be an untenable situation. So you can make a properly executed Tanai that, should that happen, the Kedushin ends up not being valid. That's based on the Chumash Hadeshah and Simin Reish Kaf Gimel. And the possibility, the Chumash Hadeshah says, nowadays, Tosfos notwithstanding, that we do Kedushin and Suet at the same time, B'Shas Sopa, so you could, in theory, have a properly executed Tanai B'Shas Nesuin as well. And that's the Pesach Shuvah, of course, in the Noda Behuda, in Kaf Simin Nun Vav, very detailed instructions as to how, with many complications, one in theory could execute a Kedushin Al Tanai in such a situation. So there is, on some level, a possible precedent in very limited circumstances for some kind of a Kedushin Al Tanai. Then you have the Mishnah in Yevamos Daf Kusayinu and Al Veshami Omrim Eim Emanin El Arusos. The Gemara ascribes to Veshamai this notion that Ein Tanai Benesuin. There may be resonance of that according to Beis Sola and La Halacha as well. And the Gemara in Subas and Daf Ayin Beis that Kish Al Tanai Vekin Sestam, if there's Kedushin Al Tanai, but the Nesuin is without any stipulation, Rav Amar Tzvichei Menu Get, that is a good Nesuin, because you don't assume that just because there was a Tanai in the Kedushin, there's a Tanai in the Nesuin. Ein Adam Oso Bilaso, the Ilas Znus. So that's some of the background as to on what basis, so there might have been room to suggest in any circumstance there could be such a thing as Kedushin al Tanai. What happened in this context in France was that the traditional Rabbanu in France, when this suggestion was made, sent letters to the establishment Rabbanus in the rest of Europe. And all the responses were collected in this kuntres Ein Tanai Benesuin, including from Reb Chaim, from Reb Yisrael Chanan, Chaim Ozer, Reb David Karliner, all the Gedolim of the time, signed by many other Rabbanim as well in the back, that there's no basis for such a suggestion. So it's noteworthy that most of those Gedolim that wrote didn't spend too much time explaining the halachic basis for their position. It's just dismissive out of hand. And that's a question when you're dealing with a suggestion that potentially could totally uproot our whole notion of getting the Kedushin. So do you address it with specific responses, or does that give credence to the other position that you don't want to give any credence to? So it's interesting in a slightly different context. It's a very well presented 3-part series in Ishur and Volume Ches through Yud, written by Rabbi Tzvi Gardner Shlita and another partner, which goes through some of the background of Ein Tanai Benesuin and other later movements as well. So they printed over there the following response from the Rugged Shaver to the suggestion, which was a big controversy in America in the early 1930s when Rabbi Louis Epstein for the seminary suggested another solution to the Aguna problem where anybody can appoint a shaliach at the
top of the
wedding that the wife wants a divorce and the husband's not cooperative. Appoint a shaliach in the on behalf of the husband, even without the husband. The establishment rejected that. And in that context, the Rugged Shaver wrote the following letter. Wherever that background noise is coming, if you could mute yourself, please. The Rugged Shaver wrote the following letter. Hayom 1931. Hayom kibalti mechtavo umchaveres mleya shtusim b'havolim lahatir eishes isha laharbas mzei b'Yisrael, to put it nicely, sholim mechablim krabim karam Hashem, ve'en ani rotza afli kanisim obishim divar shel Torah. There's no point in discussing the merits, k'mo b'hachdus and hedin daflam ches, and the reference there is to, it says that Dama Shetashiv Lapikaris. The Gemara indicates Dama Shetashiv Lapikaris is to a non-Jewish Apikaris. But when it comes to a Jewish Apikaris, there's nothing to talk about because you're not going to get anywhere. So the best response is silence. That's how Rabbi Gardner explains the reference there in the Rugged Shaver. So the one response, I'm sorry? Oh, we'll get to London in a minute. Interestingly, David C. Hoffman is one of the respondents that actually did present a little bit more of substance here, and he notes this is on page 10 of the Kuntres. Even though it is true that there may be very limited circumstances where it is possible to create a Tanai B'Kiddusha. But if you're going to do that, it has to be done by a Rav Gadol, who's Baki Heite B'chol Adinim HaShayachim L'zeh, who's Zahir B'Tachlis HaSehiru Sasakin HaKol Kedinu Kedas. But nowadays, that every young, inexperienced rabbi is Mesadar Kedushin, so it's Karv L'Vadai that they're not going to know how to execute a proper Kedushin Al Tanai. It may be totally impossible to do, even under the best of circumstances. It won't be done properly. And even where there is a heter of Kedushin Al Tanai, in the case of Ach Mumer, that's only in a very limited situation. But to do it wholesale, to Mevatel, Torah Skita, Mitzvah Yimin, less din, the less dayin. And that's a Kalkala She'ein Lamala Heimenu. Fine. So why is it that this kuntris was only published over 20 years after all the tshuvos had been written? So in the hakdama to this printing, they write that they had sent the galleys to Reb Chaim Ozer at the time before 1910 to print it. And Reb Chaim Ozer was holding on to it because he thought at the time that everything had died down. There wasn't any burning reason to print it. Everyone forgot about the French plan, and there was no need to further publicize it. And then he writes in the Hakdama, Ulam, Acharishin is Ora Shuv Lifneshna Taim Yamim, Sheilas Kalkala Klalis Kazos, Aide Oso Hamiturif Hayadua Belondin, Asher Banala Beis Karoshis Ahatir Agunos, that there is this, Meturaf in London, who created a factory from Bimati Ragunos, the Harem Yado Ba'azus Nora Lahatir called Laguna Shaba'ola Machada Machta, Ulavatil Ba'armumias called Taras Gitin Machalitza B'Israel. So then Reb Chaim Ozer thought, now is the time to print this kuntris Ein Tanai B'Nesuin. So what was this reference to the Meturaf in London? So for this, the information we're going to present is from the following three sources. The chapter on this episode in Rabbi Kamenetsky's biography of Chaim Ozer, a beautiful article written by Rabbi Eitan Henkin, Shem Yinkom Damo, entitled Ki Echin Beis Karoshis Lahatir Agunos, in a journal called Aviv, and a letter or an article written by Rabbi Pinny Donner in a journal called Eitz Chaim. So apparently, there is this individual by the name of Joseph Shapachnik, who was born in Kishinev in 1882, was orphaned from his father at a relatively young age, moved to Odessa, learned from Rabbanim in Odessa, got smicha from the Marsham, published his first sefer at the age of 20 with Haskama from the Marsham, and then made it to London in 1913. He was very prolific. He published a lot of kuntresim, svarim. If you look at Osar Chachma, there are almost 40 volumes of his that Osar Chachma has, and that's not the entirety of what he wrote. He started this massive project called Shas Hagadol Shebigdolim, the biggest of the big. And apparently Rabbi Donner writes that the actual volume is the biggest of the big. It's the biggest sefer that's ever published physically. The plan was to publish all of Shas with 1,000 Perushim. The only volume he ever published is Brachos. It's also on Osar Chachma, although it doesn't look like there's anywhere near 1,000 Perushim in the one on Brachos. He puts the Rambam on the side, the Rishon LeZion, be that as it may. And Osar Chachma, I found, he has a nice little English book about Chinuch Habanim. He writes that if you want to give your children a gentle and intellectual training, they should have a vegetarian diet, because a meat diet has a tendency of exciting the nervous system, and its difficult digestion brings many illnesses in its trail. But those children who are reared on eggs, milk, and its products, nuts, fruit, cereals, and cakes, will be gentle, more intellectual, and less liable to the contraction of disease. Now, had this Rabbi Shapachnik just stuck to chinuch advice, the world would have been a much better place. But apparently, first, he forayed into kashrus, which the local kashrus establishment didn't take kindly to. But even that, they wouldn't have made a big deal about. But the big deal was because in 1928, he published a 7-page kuntres called Likro L'Asurim Doror by Yosef Shapashnik, Yosef Rosh Devad HaRabbanim HaOlami, the Chevra HaKlalis Mafisei Torah, the International Rabbinic Committee of Torah Publicizers. So there were three cases that he discusses in this kuntres of women who were unable to procure chalitza from the Yavanim, either because they were in foreign countries or because they were trying to extort money or because they were Bolsheviks and weren't willing to participate. And he is matir them to remarry without chalitza on what we'll call spurious basises. And he was machtim other rabbanim with him, which, as was subsequently discovered, was not with the knowledge of the other rabbanim by and large, whose names appeared as signatories on this psak. So what were the bases of these psakim? So in one situation, there is a implicit t'nai that this woman was only going to marry the husband if he was healthy and it was a Shomer Shabbos, and he worked for a living. And then it turned out that he wasn't healthy and he wasn't Shomer Shabbos and he didn't work for a living. So, Adaita Dehachi Lo Kitcha, she never would have married the person, even though there's no explicit t'nai had she realized. And therefore, there's no t'nai. And don't bother me with Ein Adam Osa Bilasa Bilas Nus, because that's not always the case, and sometimes there are other counterbalancing situations. And in other case here, even worse, he says that the Yabim's in a foreign country. Nowadays, you can't really travel so freely. So if you can't travel freely, then there's no real need for chalitza, because in that case, he wouldn't say tabla mesa tandu mesa barmla. Woman wouldn't want to be married to someone she can't get to physically. So if they're in another country and you can't easily get a visa, then the kedusha never really chal because the daita d'hachi lo kedusha. And anyway, this woman got married at the age of 15, and maybe she wasn't really a gedola because we rely on chazaka d'rava that you have simanim at the age of 12 or 13, but that's only a chazaka, and maybe you could throw that into the mix. So on that basis, he was matir all these women to remarry without chalitza. The Beis Din in London, under the leadership of a Rav Hillman, who was the Av Beis Din of London at the time, sent this kuntres to Reb Chaim Ozer for his reaction. Reb Chaim Ozer sent around letters to the Gedolim of Eastern Europe asking for a joint opposition to this proposal or this kuntres in London. Reb Chaim Ozer writes in the letter that he sent out that if the person was matir was a reform rabbi who doesn't believe in Kedushas HaTorah, so I wouldn't have been surprised. But someone who presents himself as a Orthodox rabbi to say such a thing is unbelievable. And Rabbi Henkin actually has a picture of this rabbi in his. No, this one. The rabbinic looking figure with the umbrella. But anyway, so Chaim Ozer sent letters to the people that were the supposed signatories on the psak, and mostly they responded that they may have written a letter to this rabbi, but they never endorsed the psak. And they may have had some kind of correspondence. So Reb Chaim Ozer wrote very strongly against it, and the Chavetz Chaim wrote against it, and the Ger Rebbe, the Me'emes, wrote against it. And these exchanges were printed in the Yiddish newspapers in London at the time. And then this Shapashnik responded to the attacks against him with counterattacks. He attacked Reb Chaim Ozer, he attacked the Chavetz Chaim in the Yiddish press. And then the counterattack in an organ of the Vad Rabbanim of Warsaw called Kovetz Itonai, also known as Sir Chachma, so collected letters from all the Gedolim against this and signatures of 600 other members of the Vad Rabbanim of Warsaw. Chaim Moser wrote to Rav Kook. Rav Kook had been in London during World War II and knew this person from then. So he had Rav Kook write against in her three Pesach rank. There's a discussion in these articles about Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who apparently was reluctant to come out against this person publicly, which they speculate was Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld's general reluctance to attack any people individually in a public way. So that was in this COVID Sitonoi. There's a collection of all the letters written against these psakim of in this Kuntres Lekrol Asurim Dror. And part of the concern was beyond these three cases. There's a representation by this Rabbi Shapashnik that he was prepared. He wrote in one of his articles that he was prepared to now be matir thousands of agunos from World War I on the basis of Heterim. He wrote somewhere that there were thousands of agunos that he's prepared to be matir. So that's what caused this very strong response. Rabbi Donner writes in his article that after this all died down and this rabbi was generally delegitimatized, but he then attempted to, he stirred more controversy by trying to put up an Erev in London, which never happened before and didn't happen again until very recently. And the London Beis Din was against that as well. And they wrote to Reb Chaim Moser. And Reb Chaim Moser said, this time, don't fight this battle in the newspapers. Just let everyone know that no one should rely on the Erev, but you don't have to make it into another world war again. And then apparently the story was that he passed away a few years later and no one wanted to bury him. And it took 4 days before any of the Chevra Kedishas were willing to bury him in London. It's interesting, Rabbi Kamenetsky in his biography of Chaim Moser notes that as opposed to Chaim Moser's response in this London matter, where he collected tshuvos from, or collected letters from the entire gamut of the rabbinic establishment around the world, when he was asked to respond to the Louis Epstein suggestion in the United States, he wrote to the Rabbanim in London that you should be Mefarsi or Mecha, but we're not going to be Mefarsi in the Mecha in Eastern Europe because no one really knows about it here, so there's no need to give it more credence or more publicity if there's no concern that people are going to follow it. So that's always a balance, and it's interesting to see from Chaim Moser's perspective when to wage a public war, when not to, when to put things in the newspapers and when not to. But this is a fascinating historical event that on some level has resurfaced in different contexts since then, which is why the suggestions and the reactions are still relevant to us as well.
Who is Louis Epstein?
He was one of the leading rabbis in the seminary in the beginning of the 1900s, 1930s into the 40s.
We just had something recently with Rav Hershel Schefter, right? He was fighting against somebody.
Yep.
Yeah, Rabbi Silverman, I think Rav Schefter mentioned that he used to learn Talmud without a yarmulke, just like for whatever his, to show whatever his, you know, independence from traditional Yiddishkeit.
Yes, I think that's actually, I heard that, yes. Epstein. Okay. Very good. Have a great Shabbos.
Good, Rabbi Zilberman. Thank you. Have a good Shabbos.
You too.